Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am Fu Bunping, the Managing Editor of the Asian Banker. Welcome to yet another teleconsultation organized by the Asian Banker, the foremost provider of strategic research and business intelligence in the banking and financial services industry in the Asia-Pacific region. The Asian Banker recently completed the Asia-Pacific Banking Industry Outlook 2013 research report. This report offers a comprehensive coverage of macroeconomic issues that the region will face and analyzes the implications for the banking industry in some 17 countries. Today, we are very happy to have Mr. Manu Bhaskaran, one of Asia's most respected economists and the author of the report, to share with us his perspective on the challenges as well as opportunities facing banks in the region today. In today's briefing, Mr. Bhaskaran will touch on a few key themes. He will touch on the macroeconomic growth prospect for the region and countries that will determine the overall demand for loans and financial services. He will look at the continuing economic integration of economies in the region, especially in Southeast Asia, which will lead to increased capital investment and infrastructure that will drive growth. He also talked about emerging markets that have seen renewed growth that will create new source of growth for the region. For example, Myanmar, Bangladesh, the Philippines. Now, Mr. Bhaskaran is currently a partner of the Centennial Group, a strategic advisory firm that is headquartered in Washington, D.C. And he is the founding CEO of Singapore subsidiary Centennial Asia Advisors. Mr. Bhaskaran is also the adjunct senior research fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies in Singapore, where his main interest lies in analyzing macroeconomic policy frameworks in Singapore and the region. Prior to this, he held senior position at Societe Generale's Asia Investment Banking Division, where he supervised Asian economic and investment strategy analysis. Mr. Bhaskaran was educated at Magdalene College, Cambridge University, and at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Now, before we let Mr. Bhaskaran get on with his overview, let me just take a few moments to tell you about two events at the Asian Bankers Summit, which will be held in Jakarta from April 23rd to 25th. At the event, there will be a SMU Technology Decision Makers training workshop conducted by the Singapore Management University on vendor selection, channel management, and operational risk. The workshop will provide you with a better understanding of the key challenges and framework and to better respond to them and to drive change through your team and organization. And in the transaction banking area, at the summit, is also the International Banking Conference, which was formerly known as the Cash Payments and Trades Conference. And the theme of this year's conference is on cross-border integration and meeting the challenges of intra-regional supply chains, a theme which Bhaskaran will also talk about later in his overview. Now, these two events are happening for certain in April from the 23rd to 25th, so do mark them down in your calendar. Now, for things that are less certain, we have Mr. Bhaskaran to share with us the regional banking outlook. Mr. Bhaskaran, over to you.
Thank you very much, Bunping, and good afternoon to everyone. I'm going to focus on three issues in order to give you a sense of the unfolding landscape in the Asian macro world. I want to first talk about the cyclical outlook, where one can see several risks emerging, particularly in the earlier part of the year. But because of Asia's growing resilience, we believe that these risks can be absorbed by Asia. The second point is on the longer-term growth outlook, and what we are seeing are a number of very positive trends that suggest an acceleration in growth over the next 5 to 10 years, with ASEAN, the Southeast Asian economies, in particular, looking better and better. There are certainly a great number of risks to this very positive outlook, and we would identify political risks in the Middle East and in some countries as a particular area of concern, as well as some policy related risks. Let me now start by looking at the typical outlook and focusing first on the next chart on the main engines of growth that drive Asia's economy. As you can see from this slide, the United States remains the preeminent engine of growth. Here, what we are likely to see is, in the early part of the year, significant headwinds to economic growth, particularly because the fiscal operation of the federal government will go from being stimulative to being contractionary. However, what we are finding also is clear and growing evidence that the underlying engines of growth in the US economy, particularly those damaged during the financial crisis, are now heating to the point that they are becoming engines of growth. The housing market, for instance, is revving up very nicely, and credit flows, including to small, medium-sized enterprises, are also improving. Housing sector has tremendous multiplier effects throughout the economy, which will be very powerfully positive. And as more credit flows to small enterprises, they will hire more, and employment will recover, and you will get a nice virtuous upward circle. So we are confident that by early 2014, we'll start seeing a very strong, sustained recovery in the United States. The Eurozone is likely to be of very little help to Asia in the coming 12 months. There is economic austerity that will depress demand, and there are political stresses that will lead to episodic stresses in financial markets that will hit Asia in the form of declining confidence, in the form of volatile capital flows and volatile currency. China is seeing growth accelerating, and we in Asia will benefit from that in terms of commodity prices and volume demand for our exports. However, there are risks still for China, particularly relating to the imbalances that are built up in the economy, which I will talk about later. Japan is a mixed picture. Overall, the fiscal stimulus and the monetary easing by the government will result in a better outlook than initially expected. Nevertheless, Japan remains burdened by structural weaknesses, and while Japan is likely to be positive for us this year, it will not be a strong positive. If you look outside the major engines at the other emerging economies like Brazil and Turkey and so on, we're seeing clear signs of a slowdown. So the overall picture for this year in terms of the engines of growth is a mixed one. Lots of risk in the early part of the year, but getting better towards the end of the year. Now, risks are one thing. They suggest that the Asian economies that are vulnerable could be exposed to a number of downside possibilities. However, if you look at the next slide, which is our measure of Asian countries' resilience, i.e. what we're trying to show here is the capacity of Asian economies to absorb the shocks and bounce back from any external events. And essentially the chart shows that for virtually all Asian countries that we have here, there has been a significant improvement in this ability to absorb external shocks and to bounce back. Resilience has improved across the board, except for Vietnam, that there's been a significant deterioration. And Indonesia and Thailand, for instance, compared to the pre-crisis days, their resilience has improved significantly. So what we do here, we look at how diversified their economies are, we look at the credibility of policy in terms of central banks, in terms of fiscal policy, capacity of governments to respond effectively to an external shock. We look at the strength of balance sheets in the corporate sector, in the finance sector, which also tells us how shocks can be absorbed, and we conclude that overall there may be risks in the environment in the next 12 months, but the likelihood is that most Asian countries will be able to absorb these shocks. Let me now move on to looking at the longer term factors that I mentioned, which I see as positive. There are a number of positive drivers. First is competitiveness. In many parts of Asia, we will see a gain in competitiveness relative to China because of the rising costs and the appreciating currency in China. We also think that the worsening Sino-Japanese tensions will result in some relocation of activity from China to other countries in Asia, boosting those countries. Secondly, we see a very good chance that the investment to GDP ratio across much of Asia outside China will rise. And this will mean high economic growth because you're devoting a larger part of your output to building capacity for the future. We see a rising share of global foreign investments. We see more ASEAN companies themselves regionalizing, leading to intra-regional foreign direct investment. We see a rise in infrastructure spending. And as a result of these improvements, we see domestic companies in these countries also stepping up their investment, and that will lead to higher growth over the next few years. In addition, we are also encouraged by what we call the rise of the laggard economy. Economies that used to be underperforming for a long period of time are now coming into their own. The Philippines, for instance, we have seen some of the best growth potential the country has had in 20 years. We believe that the recovery in the Philippines is more than sustainable. We are also encouraged by the opening up of Myanmar, which is not only positive for Myanmar itself, but is very positive for the rest of the region. Myanmar's opening allows, for instance, ASEAN to be connected to India to the benefit of both those countries. Myanmar's opening also gives China another outlet to the world, and therefore reduces its dependence on the crowded Straits of Malacca routes. So Myanmar's opening has tremendous regional prospects as well. Finally, we are also seeing rising synergies from economic integration. The ASEAN economic community is beginning to take shape, and while its progress is slower than we hoped for, the fact of the matter is that the hundreds of measures that are being implemented regularly by all these countries are reducing the barriers to trade, to capital, and to people movements, and that will encourage greater economic integration, which we see as positive. What is also good is that there are new forms of integration emerging. There is cross-border integration in the form of, for instance, what's happening between Singapore and southern Malaysia, the Iskandar region. We're also seeing sub-regional integration, as in the Greater Mekong sub-region, where Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, and the two southern provinces of China are engaged in a serious effort to improve their economic interaction, and this is beginning to be very successful. So these big trends look really towards higher growth over the medium term. Let me now use the remaining minutes I have to make a few comments on the larger economies in Asia. Let me start first with China. China clearly is recovering, as I said. All the indicators, including the data that came out this morning in terms of trade data, suggest that economic momentum is improving as a result of the policy easing that was put in place in the second half of last year. And we expect that the rise in investment, the expansion of real estate activities will continue for the next few months, and that growth should end the year at a comfortable pace compared to the year before. However, we must be very careful when we look at China, because there remain significant imbalances and structural weaknesses in the system. The economic restructuring as China moves up the value chain will exert a drag on economic growth. The demographics of China are beginning to turn negative. Last year, for the first time in its history, the population of working age actually began to decline. This will intensify over the next few years, and that will exert a drag on growth. We are also seeing a need for China to rebalance its economy away from the excessive reliance on investment. The investment to GDP ratio at close to 50% is unsustainably high. It also has to move away from the growth model that basically used subsidized costs of inputs for companies, such as subsidized land, a lower than optimal cost of capital, and subsidized cost of inputs like electricity. The Chinese government is now embarking on a process of cost normalization, which will push up costs for businesses and force these businesses to restructure, and some of this restructuring will be painful. We also have a situation in China where substantial speculative excesses have built up in the system. And as these unwind, as they must over time, you could get some financial shocks in the system. This is something that we feel that many observers tend to underestimate. There's a lot of focus on the known problems, such as shadow banking, such as local government debt vehicles, but very little commentary on other imbalances, such as the extraordinarily large illegal lending market, where large holders of surplus funds get together in informal syndicates to lend money to subprime borrowers. This is a system that is unsupervised, with no capital adequacy rules, with no credit culture, no risk assessment. It is a time bomb ticking away in China. And the danger is that as China moves to a slower growth, some of the pains of restructuring could crystallize problems in the illegal lending market. So far, policy action has been quite effective in containing the risk in China. But we have to understand that no matter how good the policymakers are in China, it is a very difficult economy to manage and to calibrate very carefully. The policy instruments they have at hand in China are not as fine-tunable as they are in the more mature economy. They are forced as a result to use blunt policy instruments such as administrative measures and administrative guidance to banks and state enterprises in order to try and manage the economy. Quite often these produce results that are disproportionate and therefore could be quite risky. So the point I'm making on China is not that China is going to collapse or anything like that. Our baseline growth is close to 8%. However, we would highlight that there are significant risks in the economy and investors should be aware of these risks. Before I move on to India, let me just conclude with another comment on the risks in China relating to political risk. There's been a lot of commentary about political risks because of the Bo Xilai attack and because of increasing signs of social unrest, including the unprecedented demonstration a few weeks ago by journalists over issues related to freedom of expression, which is something new in China, relatively new in China. Our own view is that the new leadership that will be fully in charge from March onwards, led by Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, are determined to undertake significant economic reforms. And these reforms will eventually be very positive for China. In terms of politics, the main focus of these reforms will be on combating corruption, which they are determined to attack. And if they do that effectively, that should help gain the leadership and the Communist Party of China some credibility. The other reforms are going to focus principally on the economy and will relate to issues such as fiscal structures, where there's going to be a change in the allocation of revenues between different levels of government, away from the central government and more towards the local government. You'll also see some cautious and incremental reforms in the financial sector, starting with some liberalization of the capital account, very careful moves towards interest rate liberalization, but that will come later. So China is going to change significantly. Overall, it is going to be positive, but we will have to watch very carefully for the potential risks in the system as well. Let me now move on to India. India has had a bad press in the last year and a half. The politics is unstable. The corruption scandals seem to continue unabated. and business confidence has taken a knock, partly as a result of some problematical policy moves on taxation and the like. However, our view is that there is probably too much pessimism out there on India. We expect the economy to bottom out soon as a result of the central bank's policy easing that we have seen recently. We expect further easing to come in the next few months, and I think this will help to stabilize business confidence and improve the investment outlook. We also have seen evidence that the business sector is beginning to feel a bit more confident about government policy, including foreign investors, and this will also help to help investment to regain momentum. While some of the negatives in the short term, such as the need to rein in the large fiscal deficit, remain issues, we should also bear in mind that the supply side forces for growth in India remain very, very strong. In the past, for instance, we looked at the state-by-state prospects. In the past, India's growth relied excessively on just a few states. It is simply growth in the southern cone of India, in states like Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and Andhra Pradesh, as well as Gujarat, the area around Bombay, and the area around Delhi. What we're seeing now is growth is now spreading across the country to states such as Bihar and Orissa, which used to be substantial underperformers. And we expect that improved governance in some of these states will continue to lend momentum for longer-term growth. Remember that India has extraordinarily good demographics compared to China and to the developed countries. Remember also that India's strength comes not from the top down, as is the case in countries like China or Malaysia or Singapore, but from the bottom up. And the corporate sector's re-engineering is going to improve competitiveness in certain sectors, particularly manufacturing. And as a result, the bottom-up forces in India will promote growth, helping to offset some of the problems from the policy and political side. We're also seeing very important expansion of rural incomes in India. The rural sector is benefiting from the compound positive effects of slow improvements in food security, in non-agricultural activities, and as a result, per capita rural household incomes have more than doubled in the last decade and a half. And so demand is very strong in the rural sector, and this demand is entirely independent of the global economy and of all the sexy engines of growth that are talked about, such as IT and software services and the like. So the point I'm making on India is not that it is without risk. There are significant risks, particularly with elections coming. The point I'm making is that despite these risks, India is still capable of generating significant growth. And I think after a period of slower growth in 2012-2013 compared to the 5 years before that, India should see a re-acceleration of growth over the medium term. Politics will certainly be a risk in the 2014 election, and the need to find a successor to Prime Minister Singh, who is now 81 years old, will continue to be an overhang on the market and the economy. Let me now look at Indonesia, the other giant of Asia. And the real question here is how sustainable Indonesia's progress is. Indonesia has done reasonably well. It has proven itself to be fairly resilient during the global crisis and during the global slowdown the year before. Nevertheless, it is not immune to a global slowdown. The argument made for Indonesia quite often is that domestic demand is resilient, but we should not forget that a good part of domestic demand in Indonesia depends on commodity prices, which boost rural household incomes and which boost the profitability of large companies who step up spending in other parts of Indonesia. So there is still going to be some impact from the global headwinds that we identified for the early part of this year. Nevertheless, the domestic economy remains firm. Consumer confidence remains extraordinarily high and continues to edge up, probably as a result of a good job market and rising real incomes. Until the December trade numbers came out, imports of machinery and capital goods were rising, suggesting improved investment. The December numbers were a bit weak, but we do not think that changes the trend. We have low interest rates and a still relatively unleveraged household sector and corporate sector, and therefore an economy that is still trying to grow. We have a very effective new investment minister, and as a result, foreign direct investment is rising into Indonesia, despite the problems that we all know about the investment environment in Indonesia. There are a number of concerns we have, though, for Indonesia. One is that although inflation has been quite well behaved in the last few months, we still feel that monetary policy overall has been rather weak, and that risks for an uptick in inflation remains. We're also concerned by some policy moves of late that suggest that the policymakers are turning inward and are turning a little more protectionist. This may, if they persist in this, this may cause foreign investment to slow. Overall, our view is that Indonesia is on track for 6 to 6.5% over the next few years. It is a good story. Our concern is that this really should be a much better story if policies were on a better track. Let me now conclude by summarizing what this means for the investment environment. We see low interest rates generally rising, remaining to the middle of 2015. However, as the US economy recovers, particularly by early 2014, we suspect that the financial markets will start recalibrating their expectations for monetary policy. So while interest rates will remain low for a long period of time, financial market expectations of the trajectory will change, and that could affect financial markets. Secondly, we still see significant reasons for risk appetites to be volatile. It will be driven by perceptions of policy changes in the developed markets as well as in China. And it will be aggravated by the possibility of political shocks. We're concerned about political shocks in the Middle East, where in virtually every sub-region of that big region where much of our oil comes from, pressures are building up, whether it is Syria or Egypt or the occupied Palestinian territories or Iraq, or the continuing problems that Iran has with the West over its nuclear program. A major political shock in the Middle East would send oil prices rising, and through that mechanism will be very serious constraint on Asian growth. There are also potential political problems in countries such as Malaysia, where a major election is coming in the next few weeks, and where the chances of political gridlock have unfortunately risen. Finally, we see currency volatility rising as the US, Europe, Japan, and some of the Asian countries all try to depreciate their exchange rates at the same time. So overall, the economic outlook is reasonably good beyond the middle of this year, and we should see Asian economies accelerating from 2014 onwards. However, as I outlined just now, there are some deep risks in politics, in policy, in the financial markets that investors should watch out for. Let me stop there and take any questions that there might be. Thank you.
Okay, thanks Mr. Bhaskaran for that excellent and insightful presentation. Maybe a couple of questions before we end this session. Now, from what I heard from your presentation, in the mid to the longer term, the prospect for the region looks positive, but there are still significant short-term risks. Now, in the banking industry, banks have recorded unprecedented asset and profitability growth in the past couple of years. How do you see the prospect in the short term? You see the expansion continuing to grow?
Well, economic activity will be stepped up, investment rates will rise, and therefore the demand for financial services will increase across the board. There will be great opportunities for the banks in various segments of their business. However, there are going to be some pressures. As I mentioned, one of the things that I think investors are underappreciating is this recalibration of financial market expectations of the trajectory of interest rates, particularly in the United States. If the United States economy is going to recover as strongly as I suspect by the end of this year, then the Federal Reserve will start signaling that its monetary policy will have to be recalibrated, and therefore bond yields will start responding to that and start rising. That's going to change pricing behavior in financial markets across the board. And I think that is going to create a lot of turbulence in financial markets, which I suspect a lot of financial institutions are not ready for.
Oh, and your expectation is that will happen in the next 12 months?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Now, what do you see as the biggest challenge for the banks in the short term? Inflation, you mentioned, as one, regulatory changes. So in the area of asset price inflation, how do you see government responding to that, and how do you see its impact on loan growth and the financial services?
Well, I think that's absolutely the right thing to focus on. We are going to see very volatile capital flows, and we are going to see this backing to and fro currency depreciation efforts by everyone. And that's going to make it very difficult for central banks to manage inflows of capital into our part of the world. I suspect the response will be a greater use of administrative measures. In most cases, particularly in Hong Kong and Singapore, the focus of those administrative measures will be specific to particular asset markets, and especially across the real estate market. We've seen in Singapore 7 rounds of measures to try and restrain the asset inflation that follows capital inflows, and these have not been very effective. Hong Kong is in the same predicament, and we're seeing similar asset price pressures that creating political problems for policymakers all over Asia, including in China. So I think financial institutions will have to face the risk of these administrative measures. Now, if there's a question of interest rates being raised or lowered or whatever, that is something that you can build in quantitatively, estimate, and so on. But these administrative measures tend to be very sudden, quite often they bring with them unintended consequences, and so basically raises the risk for financial institutions. And I suspect those pressures will continue in the next 12 months.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bhaskar. Now, on that note, we have to end today's session. Now, as we look forward to the year ahead, the path is fraught with uncertainties and challenge. However, Asian banks have focused on strengthening their capital base. Will no doubt find effort opportunities to grow and to strive. Now, the recording of today's session will be available on the Asian Banker website. Now, there is a detailed report on the regional outlook also available on the Asian Banker website. If you'd like to find out more, please visit our website on theasianbanker.com. And you also find information on how to get a copy of the detailed report. Now, even as we were going through the presentation earlier, we have sent all the participants an email to ask for your feedback on this session, as well as to provide you further information on how you can get a copy of the complete report. So do respond to our email, do give us your feedback. And please also remember the Asian Banker Summit that is happening towards the end of April. We look forward to seeing you in Jakarta then. I would like to thank Mr. Bhaskaran again for his wonderful insight. And we'd like to thank you for calling into this teleconsultation session. Now, on behalf of everyone here at the Asian Banker, I wish you all a happy